Hope you enjoyed your commute into the courthouse this morning. We have two cases today. The first one is United States versus Dermer. But before we begin, I'd like to make two announcements. First, Judge Sparks regrets that he is unable to be here this morning. However, he will be listening to this oral argument, and he will be fully participating in the decision-making in this case. And second, this is a TJAG-certified case, so therefore the government will be arguing first. Having noted that, Major Finnan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government? And Lieutenant Belter, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellee?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge, and may it please the Court. I am Major Mary Claire Finnan, and I, along with Mr. Brian Keller, represent the United States. I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Granted.
Thank you. This Court should affirm the findings and sentence for 3 reasons. First, the appellant effectively waived the VLC's presence when NCIS advised her that she had the right to the presence of an attorney. Second, 10 U.S.C. 1044E does not provide a right to the presence of a victim's legal counsel at an interrogation. Third, appellant's due process rights were not violated, and there is no basis for suppression under MRE 304. And finally, even if the interrogation was suppressed, this Court should affirm the malingering charge. First, appellant knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived the presence of any counsel. She was advised that she had the right to consult with an attorney prior to questioning, quote, including a retained civilian or military lawyer appointed to act as her counsel or both. And she had the right to a retained lawyer or appointed military lawyer present during this interview. That's at Joint Appendix 610. As Judge Harrell's dissent summarizes, appellee had an appointed military lawyer. She was advised of her right to have her appointed military lawyer present, and she waived her right to have her appointed military lawyer present. There is no right, because the investigators should not be deterred from obtaining voluntary confessions, Miranda and 31B are simple, clear, and unequivocal guidance to law enforcement about what an effective waiver is. Once they are given, they suffice to cover the Fifth Amendment, the Sixth Amendment, when accused does not have counsel, when an accused has counsel but the counsel is not present, when the accused suspect is a juvenile, when the suspect has some level of internal compulsion to confess unknown to the police, when the suspect's attorney is calling the station house to try to get in touch with the client and has been told the interrogation is not happening. That's Moran versus Burbine. And it should likewise suffice here, where appellant was informed of the general nature of her rights and the consequences for abandoning it. The appellant only had one appointed lawyer, and that was her VLC, and there was no coercion here. The appellant was once a victim, but there was nothing misleading here, where NCIS told others, including her victim advocate, her command, and her VLC before the interrogation, that the investigation was being closed. And when the appellant came in, she was also told the state of the evidence and that there was that this was headed toward closure.
So, counsel, you may, because this is, I think this may segue into your second point, so I don't want to get ahead of you. But as you argued in the briefs that, I'm just going to use Dermer, that Private Dermer had no right to a SVC because she was no longer a victim. Is that still the government's position?
That was something we argued, I think, more strongly before the CCA. Here, I think the government's interest in, or the government's problem with the CCA's opinion is mainly the waiver and the confusion this causes for law enforcement. So I think that would be the preferable ground for this court to rule on from the government's perspective.
Okay, so just so I'm clear. So assuming arguendo that Private Dermer had in fact requested her SVC or said, hey, where's Captain whoever? How come he's not here? Is it the government's position that NCIS would have been, should have considered that as an as a request for counsel and stop the interrogation?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, she could have effectively asked for any attorney, and that would have ended the interrogation.
Upon what basis, then, can an NCIS policy terminate attorney-client relationship?
I don't think, that is, as you said, a policy decision. I don't think this court has to get there because of the waiver in this case. She effectively waived the presence of any counsel. And I think NCIS did have a policy that said they could, in this case, there was an effective investigation, and the appellant should have known because her representatives were notified that the investigation was going to be closed. Not all the paperwork had been done yet, and that the government admits this was not done. There's sort of different policies for closure of a case when the victim is non-cooperating. That's in the Doty that's cited, 5505-18, I think. There's a separate policy when it's unfounded. That's an NCIS policy. So those things are still being hashed out at a policy level, but I think the law is clear that she waived any right she had to an attorney at this point.
Okay, and assuming that, I guess one of my questions are that the existence or not existence of the investigation of the original sexual assault allegation and how NCIS titling can affect her rights as a victim. And in particular, how does the government reconcile that in 1044 Echo, Boleg Bravo, Boleg 10, it specifically says that with regards to issues of retaliation, that counsel can provide assistance and consultation even after criminal investigation proceedings are done. So my reading of that, particularly in the retaliation provision, is that it doesn't matter what NCIS does or doesn't do, the victim still has a right to the SVC.
I think she does. She was still represented by the VLC at the time.
Okay. Thank you.
Of the interrogation, Your Honor. And
counsel, I have a question. So it seems like the government's argument now is that in waiving counsel, she waived both her right to a defense counsel and also to her VLC simultaneously. And that seems to suggest that the roles are somewhat blurred or at least overlapping. And I sort of thought it was the government's position from your briefs that they're very distinct roles, and defense counsel come with, they are guaranteed for a certain set of constitutional statutory reasons, and VLC are provided to victims for a different set of reasons to protect different rights. But it seems now that you're sort of blurring that line by suggesting that her waiver of one waived the other. Why would, if they are distinct roles with distinct purposes that protect distinct rights, why would the waiver of her defense counsel prior to the interrogation also waive her right to have her at VLC there?
I think it's looked at from her perspective, Your Honor, where she's advised that she has a right to the presence of an attorney, and it's not for NCIS to sort of advise her on who could qualify as a defense attorney. And that's, all the more complicated in our system by the fact that you can request someone who's not in a defense billet through the IMC process. The agent here over-advised her. Appellant has never claimed this was a custodial interview and there were no charges pending at the time. But he did, in fact, advise her of the right to an attorney, and that, in her mind, would have been her appointed military counsel, who would be the could be the VLC or could be someone else.
But how do we know what was going on in her mind? You're saying in her mind this would have been the case, but why would that be?
She had an appointed military counsel, and this was the appointed military counsel, Your Honor.
But it seems to go to the point that Judge Hardy was making. There seems to be tension between your arguments and your brief saying very different roles and so forth, and now you're saying, oh, well, she would have been thinking that she was entitled to have her VLC present, and therefore, when she was given the advice about counsel, she waived it, and that covered it. Why is that not in tension with some of the arguments you're making in your brief about these two very distinct roles?
I think one is the role, I think it's from the perspective of the government and NCIS and her perspective. So a waiver can be broad, and certainly the terms of the waiver were broad here, but the government is still still obligated to keep these roles separately, and attorneys themselves are obligated to understand that their roles are different in each type of billet they have, I guess. And most importantly here, no case law supports that agents have to sort of help an accused calibrate their decision for waiver. If Congress had wanted to create a presence requirement, they could have, but instead they stated that she had to be notified of her availability of VLC, and she was, because she was still represented by VLC. Miranda itself doesn't require specific language of a waiver. The CCA opinion doesn't quite say whether it's based on the notice of availability requirement or the representation at proceedings provision, but either way, this was satisfied here. The court had no reason to presume that this waiver was invalid, especially when the military judge had already ruled it voluntary. In fact, assuming that the VLC provided the services they were authorized to provide, she was a better informed accused when she walked into that room than most.
Major, I see your time is starting to expire. You've got three more issues.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Hardy, do you have more questions on that?
I mean, something, maybe you'll get to this, but let's just assume for a moment we think you were wrong and that the VLC should have been there. That doesn't necessarily, as you've pointed out in your briefs, that doesn't necessarily mean that she's entitled to the remedies that she seeks. What is the remedy for failure of the government to provide a VLC in an interview under the statute?
I think Judge Holyfield, in his concurrence or partial dissent, discusses some of the remedies available to any military. But also, not all rights have a remedy. I think that was United States versus Adcock. And here, certainly, they don't have a remedy in evidence suppression. Evidence suppression of statements is governed by MRE 304. MRE 304 provides that on the Sixth Amendment, and 305, I'm sorry, but Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, a due process violation through compulsion or coercion or issue with Article 31.
So then what is the mechanism to ensure that there are not future transgressions of the statutory rights, regulatory rights of the service members in these scenarios?
I think discipline of maybe the NCIS agents, some sort of complaint there, but I think I don't think evidence.
And is that a transparent process where people would know whether there was any disciplinary action taken or not?
No, I don't think so. But even so, there's no right to the, moving on to our second point, there's no right to the presence of a VLC at an interrogation because an interrogation is not a proceeding. This is sort of a common sense assessment because if an accused had any victim had a right to representation at an interview, the statute itself doesn't distinguish between an interrogation of her versus an interrogation of the person she's accusing. So we just know this wouldn't work out. But statutory
Well, expand on that. So we've got the language that says any proceedings in connection with the military investigation of an alleged sex-related offense. So you're now saying because this would not include tertiary witnesses, that it can't include the person who's being investigated for false statement arising from a situation where she initially was viewed as the victim?
Yes, Your Honor. I think proceedings, I mean, they use the words proceedings, so a proceeding that could result from the reporting of the complaint that never goes anywhere, really, other than maybe an NJP proceeding or something. It can come from the investigation, so certainly when someone else makes an allegation of a sex assault, not the victim herself, any proceeding that stems from that, and any proceeding that stems from the court-martial process itself.
But how do we get away from the plain language? Any proceedings in connection with military investigation of alleged sex-related offense?
Well, I think the term is proceeding, sir. As this court has defined it in Batters, it implicitly rejected the defense's broad definition. In Batters, you looked at the UCMJ itself and the MCM, which is a longstanding administrative construction against which the statute was passed. And the case seemed to implicitly accept the government's argument that most times proceedings refers to a particular court-martial, and it may sometimes also be used not in reference to court-martial but some other adjudicatory or disciplinary proceeding. You see this in RCM 502. Defense counsel can represent an accused in military investigations or proceedings, which implies they are two different things. And then the obstructing justice statute, proceedings as disciplinary or criminal. And then Article 6B, which was passed around the same time, has the right to not be excluded from public proceedings to reasonably heard at for the victim to be reasonably heard at proceedings of a clemency and parole board, the right to proceedings free from unreasonable delay. So these all imply a more formal non-investigatory steps. And finally, the civilian case law that we cited in our brief from the Ninth Circuit in 2013, Amolian, proceedings do not include a criminal investigation, which is, of course, is where an interrogation falls. And then the context of the statute itself, 1044E has the right to consult and advise on military justice proceedings, the military justice system, the right to consult with the defense counsel, but not actual sort of a distinction in criminal, in the criminal context. And, of course, the statute itself recognizes that distinction. May I briefly touch on the third
point? First, let me check any further questions from my colleagues on the bench.
She may touch on what I was about to ask. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Finally, there was no due process violation here.
Now, counsel, your time has expired. I thought you were going to conclude.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, this court should affirm the findings and sentence.
Did you have questions, though, Judge Johnson, that you wanted to pose on that ground?
I should come back on rebuttal.
Thank you, Major Finnan. Lieutenant Bilter.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, honorable judges of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Commander Raymond Bilter, and I represent the appellee in this case, Private First Class Daniel D. Reamer, United States Marine Corps. Congress enacted 10 U.S.C. 1044 ECHO to prevent questioning of an alleged victim about her reported sex-related offense without her special victim's counsel. This court should affirm the lower court's decision for certified questions 1 through 3 because, first, appellee's statutory right to her SVC was deliberately violated by NCIS. Second, this amounted to a due process violation. And third, per MRE 304A1A, suppression is the remedy for a due process violation. This court should reverse the lower court's decision for certified question 4 because her resulting confession from all of this caused prejudice. First, with regard to the statutory provisions, especially the term proceeding as it's used in the statute, a harmonious reading of the whole statute informs the analysis. And specifically, subsection B8B authorizes legal consultation and assistance, are the words, legal consultation and assistance in any proceedings of the military justice process in which a victim can participate as a witness or other party. And in addition, Bravo 1 authorizes legal consultation regarding potential criminal liability of the victim stemming from or in relation to the circumstances surrounding the alleged sex-related offense and the victim's right to seek military defense services. In this case, the SVC could not perform that statutorily authorized consultation when he was completely and deliberately excluded from this interrogation. Additionally, subsection F2 also informs the analysis here. When F2 requires the notice by law enforcement of the availability of a special victim's counsel prior to being asked questions about the alleged sex-related offense, which NCIS did in this case, they're supposed to notify them of the availability of an SVC, and that wasn't done in this case either. It doesn't make sense for Congress to have enacted F2 if they didn't contemplate having an SVC present for this exact type of questioning. And therefore, a reading of the statute as a whole indicates that the term proceeding is intended to be used in its very general sense and encompasses this exact type of interrogation. And specifically, in the record, the special agent starts out by asking her, "So how have you been, Doremer, since the last time we spoke?" He's referring back to the interview when she had her SVC present, and it's the same exact agent that she was speaking with 3 months prior. He then goes on to say, "Tell me what happened." He's asking her about her alleged sex-related offense. And then she goes into detail again, initially standing by her allegation of sexual assault. So the plain language of this statute is directly triggered because this is the type of questioning that NCIS is employing. In terms of waiver, the government counsel, you know, touched upon, you know, that this was a waiver, this was a voluntary waiver. Our argument is that this type of attorney-client relationship is more analogous to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel than the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. And the government referenced Moran v. Burbine. And in Moran, the Supreme Court said if this were the Sixth Amendment right to counsel context, the analysis, the result would be very different, citing Maine v. Moulton. In Maine v. Moulton, the Supreme Court says that when law enforcement question a person without their counsel present, it, quote, circumvents the protections accorded the accused by invoking this right, end quote. And that's exactly what we have here. Per the statute, the right to an SVC attaches at the time that the alleged victim essentially seeks out that SVC and makes it a restricted or unrestricted report. Analogous to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, that right attaches at a specific point. In the Sixth Amendment context, it's preferral of charges. In this context, it is the entering of an attorney-client relationship and at a minimum, making a restricted or unrestricted report of sexual assault.
Counsel, assuming that we agree with you, and this is just an assuming to get to the question, that 10 U.S.C. 1044 ECHO provided a right for the SVC to be present, or at least to be notified, notwithstanding how NCIS characterized it. Why would Private Doremer's waiver not be knowing and intelligent?
Your Honor, first, so we're arguing that in order for it to be a valid waiver, per the analogy to the Sixth Amendment, the counsel also needs to be informed, and the counsel needs to waive their presence as well. Otherwise, it's a per se violation. If this court disagrees with that analogy, however, under the conventional Fifth Amendment standard for knowing and intelligent waiver, that also did not occur in this case, specifically because there was trickery and misleading going on both before this interrogation and before she was read her rights. Government counsel argued just now that she, before she waived her rights or read her rights, she was informed of the state of the evidence. But the NCIS agent testified on the record that he intentionally lied about the state of the evidence to her in an effort to maximize the potential that she would waive her rights. Miranda says you can't do that. You can't trick or cajole somebody into waiving their rights. And he was doing that before her rights were even read. That, coupled with the fact that in the interview with the same agent 3 months prior, he had left her by saying, I don't think I'm going to need to speak to you again, but if I do, I'll be sure to go through your SVC, or words to that effect. He was giving her the impression that he was going to respect that attorney-client relationship, and then NCIS did the exact opposite and never disabused her of the notion that the NCIS agent hadn't done what he said he was going to do, which was go through the SVC to approve of this. And so she was in a completely uninformed and misled situation. And for those reasons, this was not a knowing and intelligent waiver of those rights if this Court decides to employ conventional Fifth Amendment analysis.
So are you arguing that this is case-specific? It's because of this misleading, your characterization of the conduct of NCIS? Or are you saying there is a broader principle that in every instance where someone is being investigated for, let's say, a crime that is not the sex-related offense, that in every instance the person who becomes the accused needs to be informed directly of their right to the SVC?
We are not asking for that latter, broader rule, Your Honor. Not in every case. No, Your Honor. Specifically...
So then could you just recapture in a fairly straightforward manner, what particular facts of this case move this into a scenario where this Court should hold in Appley's favor?
For two alternative reasons, Your Honor. First, per subsection F2 of the statute, any time that a military criminal investigator requests any statement from the individual regarding the alleged sex-related offense, notice of availability of an SVC needs to be given, and proper waiver of the presence of the SVC needs to also be coordinated through that SVC themselves. So we are arguing that categorical rule. We're asking this Court to hold that
categorical
rule.
Principle.
Yes, Your Honor. Alternatively, if this Court disagrees, then at least the specific facts of this case warrant relief.
And what specific facts are you focusing on?
Specifically, the misleading actions and statements of NCIS in this case, in addition to the pre-rights advisement trickery that occurred. And to that latter point, that was its own legal theory presented to the CCA. The CCA did not take up that theory. Instead, they decided the case on the statutory theory. And so if this Court is inclined to rule based on those other theories that we believe are outside the scope of the certified questions, we ask this Court to remand the case back to the CCA so that they can opine about those preserved and raised theories as to Miranda-specific trickery and allow them to opine about those legal theories in the first instance.
So from your perspective, you were talking about alternative theories. If we were to focus on the second part, the case-specific, fact-specific instances, you're saying we would not need to reach the broader universal principle that you first articulated?
Your Honor, I think that this case presents the scenario that's ripe for this Court to reach the broader categorical principle. The field clearly...
But you're not saying it's necessary.
It's not absolutely necessary to warrant relief under if this Court views this as a trickery or misleading situation that tainted that rights advisement, then...
No, I didn't want to cut you off. You were about to say why this court should reach the first principle you articulated.
Yes, Your Honor. This case indicates that the field needs guidance about how to interpret this statute and where the left and right boundaries of the statute lie. We know from the record Joint Appendix page 959, that the Victims Legal Counsel Program of the Marine Corps said that they are seeing, quote, a pattern of NCIS deciding clients are lying about their sexual assault and trying to interview them without telling the VLC, end quote. This is in direct contravention to the DODI that implements this statute that squarely says, quote, once a victim is represented by an SVC, further communications with the victim will be coordinated through the assigned SVC. And that's DODI 5505.18, section 31B2. And so NCIS clearly is not following that DODI, or they are interpreting the DODI and this statute in a vastly different way that directly runs afoul of these established attorney-client relationships. And so this case is ripe for this court to opine and give guidance about the left and right boundaries of this statute and to treat this attorney-client relationship akin to the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and give guidance to the field that that is how this attorney-client relationship should be respected and how they should conduct themselves in these situations where they want to go back and ask that same alleged victim more details about her reported sex-related offense.
I'm curious about your theory here. Is in the second of the two scenarios you laid out, if appellee had not been the original alleged victim, but just a witness, but the same things had happened. The government had eventually decided that she wasn't just a witness to some other assault; that she was the actual person who committed the assault, and they went through the same trickery. Would that have created, but she didn't have a VLC because she was never the alleged victim, would that have created the same due process concerns in your mind? Or do those due process concerns only come into existence because of the statutory right to the VLC?
The former, Your Honor. I think your question is if she was the assailant
just a witness, right? She doesn't have a VLC. She's not the alleged victim. But they've spoken to her a couple times during their investigation, and then they come to think, oh, no, you're the criminal actor here. And they bring her back, and the exact same scenario happens, right? And your concerns about their trickery, right? Would that also create a due process? Would there still be a due process violation even without any statutory right to a VLC? Is that just part of our Fifth Amendment jurisprudence, or is that your argument on the second part? It doesn't really have to do with her statutory right to a VLC. It just has to do with the way the interview is conducted. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Then it would be a different type of due process violation. It would be a Miranda type due process violation, because Miranda says you can't trick or control somebody into waiving their rights, and so it would be a Miranda violation. Whereas here we have that, but we also have this other type of due process violation because the statute Congress is conveying a personal liberty interest, and the Supreme Court says when legislatures do that, that right becomes protected by the due process clause, and that's why this is that type of due process violation as well. And MRE 304 says, well, when a confession or admission is obtained in violation of the due process clause, then suppression is the remedy. And so that's also what occurred here.
And can you spell out a little more? Why does the right to a VLC necessarily implicate due process? Like, the government argues these are different roles, different rights, different protections. Why does the violation of the right to a VLC necessarily implicate due process?
Yes, Your Honor. For the reasons stated in by the Supreme Court in United States v. Caceres, when reading Caceres, there are four key factors that the court identifies, which in that case the Supreme Court said we're not going to extend the exclusionary rule to this scenario because these factors weren't met. Here, we have the exact opposite. Those Caceres factors are met. Specifically, first, the statute confers a right promulgated for the benefit of appellee. This court has already opined in United States v. Harrington that this statute creates a unique attorney-client relationship between a lawyer and an alleged victim. It is not something that's supposed to regulate governmental it's not solely for the regulation of governmental conduct. It is for the benefit of an individual, an alleged victim. Second, she reasonably relied on the statutory right, which Caceres says that implicates the due process clause when there's
that
detrimental reliance. Well, first, Your Honor, she sought the services of an SVC. She brought that SVC to her initial interview with the same NCIS agent, so she's clearly invoking that right. She's exercising that right with her VLC by her side, or SVC by her side. And then NCIS even says they're going to respect that attorney-client relationship. And he says, you know, if I need to speak to you again, I'll be sure to go through your SVC. She's relying on that. And then 3 months later, she gets called in, and she's none the wiser that that this hasn't been coordinated through her SVC. There's no mention of any of that. So for those two reasons, there's a detrimental reliance on the statutory right that she had already exercised.
But as you just indicated, she had exercised that right previously. Why couldn't she exercise it the second time around? Either by saying, I'm not going to continue with questioning, or just asking the NCIS agent, so you've coordinated with my VLC? Instead, you're saying she was empowered the first time around to get VLC, but now suddenly she's doesn't have that authority based on your scenario at the second time around, that she was misled. Why the two different takes on this?
Well, in the first interview, having her lawyer present, you know, certainly gives her a certain level, it would give anybody a different level of confidence with their attorney by their side being confronted or talking with federal agents than when being confronted with federal agents by themselves alone in an interrogation room. So there's an inherently
dynamic. She was informed of her right to counsel.
She
could have gotten other counsel. Didn't need to be VLC.
Well, per the statute, she needed to be notified specifically of the availability of a special victims counsel.
Yes, but your argument right now is focusing on the fact that she was a babe in the woods all by herself. She was told she could have counsel present. Not necessarily her VLC / SVC, but she was told she could have counsel.
She was told generally that you can have the presence of a military or civilian attorney. She was told of that, Your Honor. But you know, our argument is that she was actively misled, and her SVC was also misled by NCIS's appearance of regularity. In the same way that the Supreme Court decided United States v. Yellen, that the accused in Yellen was also deceived by the appearance of institutional regularity that was not actually adhered to, and the Supreme Court dismissed the charge in that case because of the inherent unfairness. And so that's exactly also what happened in this case. And so for those reasons, appellee respectfully requests that this court affirm the lower court's decision regarding certified issues 1-3 and reverse on certified question number 4.
Before you go anywhere, let me see if there are any questions from the bench.
Yes, this was, you were, counsel, you were going through the 4, and I may have missed point 4. I know you were trying to conclude before the clock ran out, but what was your fourth point when you were going through the analysis of Caceres?
On Caceres, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
So there were two other factors, the third being compliance with the statute would have resulted in different treatment of the appellee.
Okay.
And we know from the record that that would have happened because it's in the notice of representation that's in the record that was attached at the lower court, he tried to preemptorily invoke her rights. He said, do not talk to my client without me present. She invokes all of her rights under the Fifth Amendment, Article 31, et cetera. So we know that he would have advised her to invoke her rights had he been informed of what was actually going on. And then fourth, she suffered substantially from the statutory violation because the confession or admission that resulted was the most important piece of evidence that the government admitted against her in obtaining a criminal conviction, which also then warrants a criminal law remedy through the exclusionary rule being appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Major Finnan.
The appellant here admits that there is no constitutional violation of the Sixth Amendment and asks this court to consider it as a Sixth Amendment-like violation. But he's asking for a constitutional standard of prejudice analysis. The court here should test for harmlessness at most if it does find error, because this was at most a statutory violation like Evans. And this court in Wickman from 2000 said that this is a non-structural error, or these types of violations are at least non-structural. Montejo itself, in 2009, a Supreme Court case, holds that waiver itself does not have to be counseled. And the Flanner, this court held that agents' statements don't create rights themselves. So the argument that by saying, I'll contact your VLC, and then contacting her three months later without VLC didn't create any rights in itself.
Well, but counsel, the appellee arguing that the reasonable reliance on the representation by the NCIS agent? So he set the expectations that he would have notified and coordinated with the SVC prior to calling her in. Is that, do you see that that's, you don't see that as a distinction?
No, Your Honor. In Flanner, the appellant was advised that they were over-advised of their rights, and this court found that they didn't actually, in fact, have those rights.
Okay.
The government here finds the CCA opinion totally unworkable. It reads into a statute words that are not there. This reasonably should have known of having a VLC, and the statute, of course, provides a VLC for both restricted and unrestricted reports. It provides more protections for an arbitrary class of people who have VLC, who still retain VLC, who have actually military VLC, so a narrower type. And it undoes the uncertainty of a rights advisement. As for the due process concerns that appellant has raised, appellant never relied on the particular instructions that Judge Gross brought up in his concurrence at the trial level or even in their CCA brief. It's only those instructions that talk about contact through a VLC. It's not the statute. And Caceres, there are so few cases that actually use Caceres to provide relief through evidence suppression because of the general understanding, even in Caceres itself, that
Let me just see first whether there are any further questions from the bench. Yes, you may briefly conclude.
Thank you. From passing protective regulations, suppression and an overly strict adherence to regulations would discourage regulations at all that are protective of an appellee's rights. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 11:30.
The court stands in recess until 11:30.